yo, what is a cipher?
Nobody pays attention to an idiot for too long.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 106, a talk with one of the founding fathers of punk rock, John Lydon, a.k.a. Johnny Rotten. Lydon was the singer of the Sex Pistols, the groundbreaking British punk band managed by impresario Malcolm McLaren. McLaren was also an early popularizer of hip-hop, recording rap songs as early as 1982. Lydon himself collaborated with pioneer Afrika Bambaataa and was in his own music, a pioneer in the use of drum machines and sampling. The Sex Pistols formed in 1975, and their raw sound combined with Lydon's powerful, unfiltered lyrics taking shots at the Queen, the music industry, and the system as a whole created something entirely new. A sound, look, and attitude that would quickly be picked up and copied by legions of bands to follow and would spark the punk rock revolution. The Sex Pistols broke up in early 1978 after a short-lived U.S. tour that famously featured Rotten asking the audience, "Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?" at the group's final show. Bassist Sid Vicious would die the following year. Lydon went on to form the influential group Public Image Limited, or PIL. The group went in an entirely different direction, making often danceable, experimental music. Their second album, 1979's Metal Box, is generally regarded as a landmark release and was chosen as one of the 500 greatest albums of all time by Rolling Stone. Lydon is still making music with PIL today. His new memoir, which covers his whole life and career, is called Anger is an Energy, My Life Uncensored, published by Day Street. He was joined by Lauren Jackson of HarperCollins, who you can hear chime in occasionally in the background. We were also joined for the occasion by the photographer Jeanette Beckman, an upcoming Cypher guest herself. She took iconic pictures of Lydon and the Pistols back in the 1970s, as well as some of the most important hip-hop photos and album covers of the genre's golden age. You can see some of the photos she took of Lydon at thecyphershow.com. If you enjoy The Cipher and want to help us continue, visit patreon.com/thecyphershow to make a donation. We even have special rewards and experiences for our donors. Also, find us on iTunes. From there, you can rate, review, and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. The more five-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests. And now, here's the only man who ever really understood punk, John Johnny Rotten Lydon. John, thank you for coming by.
Hello. It's so odd.
We got to, you know, we got to do our soundproofing where we can.
No, I get down when it gets a bit hot for me, but I like really cold. It's my natural way to function. Then my brain starts to unravel on me.
Well, you've been living in LA for a long time. You're not used to the hot
weather
yet.
Yeah, but no, I'm right on the beach where it's never what you would call warm.
Mm, that makes sense. So... since we're, you know, your memoir, Anger is an Energy, is what brought you here.
Never heard of it. Don't know nothing about it, Gov.
Well,
someone did it.
Someone with your name and who looks a lot like you is on the cover.
Bastard.
It's after a one line, right? A line from Rise. that you called like one of the most powerful lyrics you'd ever come up with. So it's been probably about 30 years or so since you wrote the song. What does anger mean to you now?
Anger is what helped me remember who I was when I was young. When I was 7, I had the misfortune to contract meningitis. That put me in a coma for quite a few months. When I came out of the coma, I had forgotten everything. I could not walk. I could not talk. I knew no one. I didn't even know who I was. I was in complete and utter mental isolation. These people sitting at the end of the hospital bed that were making poi movements my way absolutely terrified me. I did not want anyone to touch me. They turned out to be my parents. But that took something like, all in all, probably 4 years to fully recover my memory and find this out. That was a very, very long period of isolation. But I'm not complaining, and there is no self-pity in this. That period made me what I am today. The anger that my parents had to keep me in, the state of rage, was in order to promote my memory, to return my memory to me. Wonderful. So for me, anger is an energy. It was the gift of life. I remembered who I was finally. According to the hospital, if I was allowed to be mollycoddled or self-pitied in any way at all, I might have just become very cozy and forgotten myself completely for the rest of my life. Anger is an energy.
Yeah, something else that helped you get your memory back was reading, right? Can you explain the role books played in your recovery?
Well, I could read and write at 4 before I went to a primary school. There's two distinct areas of schooling in England. There's between 5 to 11 and then 11 to 16. I could read before I went to school. Mum and Dad, being Catholics and raising us as such, sent me to a Catholic school, which was run by nuns. And they absolutely resented me because my mother forgot that I was left-handed, should have sent me elsewhere. To be left-handed in a Catholic school was seen as a sign of the devil. And that did not set me off well at school. And so isolation and terror from the powers that be was my first introduction to the education system. At 7, the meningitis came. I didn't really stand much of a chance of making friends here. And I've made up for that ever since. And my love of humanity and all things living is the overwhelming driving force in me from such ridiculous suppression in my childhood.
Yeah, and you were saying reading books
reading
that you had
everything,
read before the meningitis helped bring your memory back.
Yeah, after that, I mean, I went to the library. I would go to the libraries on my own, all right, and just read my way back. The library was a very, very useful place. I joined the art club there at 9, and from there on in, things just came back in. I learned all over again the shape of words. And just to this day, I love the written word. Not so, the content's very relevant to me, but the shape of words is very, very relevant to me.
And one more thing about the illness, you know, as awful as it was responsible in some ways for key parts of your stage persona, right? It messed with your eyesight, so we get famous rotten stare. It, you know, attacked your spine, so you have your kind of hunched stage persona.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you explain a little bit
about
that?
Well, the injections they would give me, they were I think they were penicillin-based, but they would inject me in the tip of my spine, which is just before the anus. Also, they would draw fluid out through the spinal column at the bottom of the spine. But the trouble with that, they were called lumbar punches, was that it curved my spine. And so that I can't stand up completely erect. If I do, I'll get dizzy and pass out. So I have to be always slightly hunched for the rest of my life. My eyesight was completely destroyed. It took many, many years of wearing hideous National Health glasses before I've got anything like a proper focus. I could see far distance very, very well, but nothing up close. And so things like cutting my toenails is a real seriously dangerous thing to do. It's a bloodbath every single time, no matter what focals. Can you imagine how many times I've missed the toilet bowl?
I don't know if I can. So living in England, but having Irish parents, seems like you had, issues around identity from the beginning. You say in the book that when you went to Ireland to visit your family, they thought of you as English.
Yeah.
But when you were in England, you were hated for being Irish.
Yeah.
What kind of effect do you think being in between identities like that had on your worldview, your art?
No bitter long-term resentment, actually a love for ignorant people, hoping that somehow or other they might get better. Keep smiling through. Smile in the face of adversity. I think this is the proper answer, rather than a self-pity, hatred, or violence. And I found through my life, humour has paid off really, really well. Gets me out of all manner of trouble.
I'm sure. So you joined the Pistols, right? And right after joining, you say in the book, you had to very quickly find my own voice. And you say that was pure hell and torture.
Yeah.
What was that like, and why was that
so
difficult?
Well, listen, the reason I couldn't hold a note was because I'd spent all of my earlier childhood trying to avoid being put in the choir. Now, Catholic schools being what they are, you didn't want to go anywhere near the choir because that meant the priests would have direct access to you. And we all know what Catholic priests are famous for, and it isn't religion. Bingo. I unlearned how to sing. Joined the Sex Pistols. Well, find my voice. Well, I did. I found my voice through the sheer fear of it. I really wanted this job, see. This was a chance for me to, like, say all the pent-up things that mattered to me in life. And I had to find a voice. And when I heard myself back for the first time through monitors, it was horrible, just disgusting. It wasn't at all like any of the wonderful singers I was imagining I sounded like. No Roy Orbison here. Honky donkey, sir. But I found myself, I did. I found somewhere in there, there's a part in your brain where you just focus on what the meaning of the words you're using are. Bingo.
Yeah. And you say that about singing in the book, about how it doesn't necessarily have to be correct, but it has to be accurate.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Emotionally accurate is far more relevant than any kind of note perfect in tune nonsense. I don't fully comprehend what people mean when they say in tune. Is that because they've put the instruments before the voice? Now, my way of approaching it is the voice first. That is the first instrument that ever came into the wonderful world of music. Instruments came after. First is the voice. Match the voice. The voice is the heart and soul of you. Don't ask me to be in tune with a saxophone. I don't know who is.
So one of the things that I was super curious about was like the live performance part of the business. Because
hold on, that nasty coffee went and the wrong way. Can I have another cup?
Oh, okay.
I am. I'm deadly serious.
Okay. Yeah, this should be plenty. So right off the bat with the Pistols, you didn't have really any experience as a live performer, and you're getting all this negative crowd reaction. That's something that it takes sometimes experienced performers, you know, have a hard time with it.
Let me explain to you that it was people watching me. This is the first time I broke out of my shyness. This is incredible. And whether they all hated me all at once, and in fact, there was a time where I thought the whole world did, it was still an achievement, right? I'd cracked the egg, you know, the chicken had hatched. and it may be making squalicker noises, but that's a damn fine chicken I am there. Squawk, squawk.
You just mentioned people hating you. You felt like the whole world hate you.
I don't think they hated me. I don't think they ever heard anything like what I had to say. And I had a chance to express my opinions and share them with other people. That's wonderful. Whether they resent you for that or not, that's an achievement for me.
There was a point, though, at which you were basically a prisoner in your own home, right?
There was a point in my life where I was a prisoner in my own head, not knowing who I was. Remember that? Between 7 and 12. So everything else is just icing on the cake in comparison to that isolation. So, yes, of course, it was hounded by the press and all of that.
John and the Sex Pistols managed to create a ton of outrage in Britain with their music and their antics. They played their vicious anti-monarchy song, God Save the Queen, on a boat along the River Thames to mock the Queen's Silver Jubilee celebration. They also cursed on live television and a whole lot more. As we discuss here, for much of the band's heyday, Lydon couldn't even leave his own house for fear of being beaten or worse by people whipped up by the media frenzy. Following one particularly offensive television appearance, the Daily Mirror famously ran the headline, The Filth and the Fury. Bernard Brooke Partridge, a conservative member of the Greater London Council and chairman of the Arts Committee from 1977, declared, "Most of these groups would be vastly improved by sudden death. The worst of the punk rock groups, I suppose, currently are the Sex Pistols. They are unbelievably nauseating. They are the antithesis of humankind. I would like to see somebody dig a very, very large, exceedingly deep hole and drop the whole bloody lot down it."
That was a privilege, not something to like be fearful of, really, when I look at it properly. So the paparazzi to me is a reward for services rendered.
Do you remember when you first realized, hey, it's kind of dangerous for me to be outside by myself?
Yeah, no, of course there would be gangs of hooligans that would love to like tear me head off because, you know, that was what the media charge was all about, wasn't it? To stir up hatred. But even that alone in itself was a form of attention. I mean, I can't be wrong all the time, can I? And if you get so much negativity thrown at you in such huge amounts, I don't care how dumb and stupid you are, you have to realise that this is because you're saying something right, not wrong. Nobody pays attention to an idiot for too long. Fantastic. You know, and there it is. That's what should go on my gravestone. Didn't get none of it wrong. Actually, I don't want a gravestone. No. I want a car park bollard.
So, the portrait of you paint of Sid Vicious in the book, it's warm and unflattering. In a lot of ways, kind of both at the same time.
Well, flattery will get you nowhere, all right? But accuracy is the thing. This is one of my best mates, and I have to tell it like it is. Listen, Sid was as awkward in the world as I was, right?
Yeah.
And there it was, and that's how we got on with it. It's a privilege, really, to meet other people that feel just as put out and left out as yourself.
And
that's what I've been doing all my life, ever since, really, is collecting oddball people around me. And find out that ultimately we all feel left out. And that's the privilege of really becoming a true human being, to know that you really are an individual and you will die completely alone, no matter who's around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you have to face up to yourself a long time before it gets to that terminal position.
Yeah.
And there it goes. So I'm very happy about that.
And one of the funny things about Sid that you mentioned in the book is when you first met him, you guys were like 14, 15, and he was really proud both of his looks and of being a virgin.
Here's how John describes a young Sid Vicious in his book. Sid wasn't a threat to anybody. His thing was, I look better than Bowie and I'm a virgin. That was his selling point. At that age, that was incredibly brave. Everyone our age between 14 and 15 was like, oh no, I'm not a virgin. Sid ran it the other way. No, I'm a complete virgin. I love that very much about him.
No, yeah, I don't think he was proud of it. It was just the way it was. But the look side was absolutely the most conceited person I've ever known in my whole life. And spotty and ugly as hell. So it was genius, really, of him to convince himself that he was so fabulous. So, I mean, how can you not like someone that really, you know, looks ridiculous, really, really just be walking around like that in a mirror all the time, poor Sid. And a very, very, very serious Bowie fan. And I think that's where he got that thing from. He imagined he was Dave Bowie.
He looked in the mirror and saw Bowie.
That's right.
Yeah. After his death, you said you wrote songs about him for a long time.
Every now and again, an idea would pop up that would be appropriate. Yeah. I'd very, very annoyed and sad and disappointed that heroin took him over. And it's heroin what killed him. Yeah. And that will always, like, play in my mind.
Are there songs of yours that are about him that maybe people wouldn't realize are about him?
I'd rather not say. Let the listener work that out themselves. You know, sometimes my songs cross-reference, cross-point, and hit many, many targets all at once. And I like it. They like it to be left open to the interpreter, which I call the listener. My songs don't come in instruction manuals.
So one of the things that kind of widened your split with Malcolm McLaren was this radio show you did back in 1977, Johnny Rotten, the Punk and His Music. Right, where you talked, you played some of your favorite records, this kind of wildly eclectic thing, Tim Buckley and Augustus Pablo and Bobby Bird.
The following program is dedicated to the belief that there's always two sides to a story. All the music that you will hear has been chosen by Johnny Rotten and is from his personal collection. It's been mixed for stereo listening, most effectively experienced in headphones. The Johnny Rotten Show, The Punk and His Music.
Let's wrap up a really, really tedious interview. Because if it comes to it, that's exactly what it is. Just play the records.
Why would your manager object to you sharing your record collection?
Yes, it was the Capital Radio Show. I suppose he was fancying himself as the image builder of the band. Well, he forgot to tell me what that image was, and I will do whatever I want to do whenever I want to, and that's exactly what I did. I love music. I don't care what their hairdos or style of clothing is. If it catches my attention and it's well written and the words are accurate, I want lots of it. All of it, in fact. And ignorance is like Malcolm's attitude. Don't really count. I mean, he just made himself look incredibly foolish for resenting that. So what he was trying to do was dustbin lid us. You know, to label us morons, you know, and him as the genius. Well, it worked out differently, didn't it? May he rest in peace.
So I want to jump ahead for a minute with the Sex Pistols. You guys get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and you write them a very nasty rejection note, which became pretty famous.
Here's Lydon's public rejection note on behalf of the Sex Pistols regarding their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the attendant induction ceremony, which Lydon says in the book it would have cost the band up to $25,000 to attend. Next to the Sex Pistols, rock and roll and that Hall of Fame is a piss stain. Your museum, urine and wine. We're not coming. We're not your monkey, and so what? Fame at $25,000 if we paid for a table, or $15,000 to squeak up in the gallery? Goes to a non-profit organization selling us a load of old famous? Congratulations. If you voted for us, hope you noted your reasons. You're anonymous as judges, but you're still music industry people. We're not coming. You're not paying attention. Outside the shitstem is a real Sex Pistol.
I thought it was very touching.
Yeah.
Almost sentimental of me.
So the thing with that note is they turn around...
Well, now let me explain.
Sure.
This is a the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What is it? It's the institution, the music institution. These are the record labels and business people that have made my life in the wonderful world of music a living hell. Right? There's a lot that have suffocated me and not supported me and left me stranded there for some, 20 years where I couldn't raise the money to buy out of the contracts, you know, left in the wilderness. And I'm going to accept an award from that lot. Am I? Fuck. Fuck off. Right? Burn the fucking building down. Sorry about my French, but I've got no time for that. And the arseholes that run and receive those awards really infuriate me. They're the wrong uns in life, the Green Days, that think that that's an accolade to be supported by a system that suppresses individuality. There is so much policing from the powers that be that come from large labels. They are the corrupt of corrupt. They stifle us, they cheat us, they do us out of our deals, they steal our copyrights. They mispromote us. They miseducate the public. They don't defend us when we're assaulted or attacked. No, I cannot accept an award from that institution. It is wrong. And hence my touching romantic letter to them, which they now put in the museum.
So this happens with you.
Isn't that telling you something?
Yeah, this happens with you a lot, I think. You'll make some kind of rebellious gesture and it eventually, or in that case, very quickly, gets turned into history, quote unquote history, right? Mm. How do you feel about that dynamic? Is it frustrating? I think
the point being is that they can't ignore it. And so they have to go with the flow. And I don't think that that's watering down my message at all. I think it's quite the opposite. I think it points them in the right direction. They actually have to realize what a bunch of arseholes they are.
So you formed Public Image Limited after the Pistols' demise. At the very beginning, I was listening to an interview you did, probably 78, right at the beginning of Pill. You said, listen, as a band, Public Image Limited will either win or lose. There can't be no in between. 37 yeah. years later, did you win or lose?
I'm still at it. It's an ongoing process. For me, emotionally, it's a complete success. I think something like 50 people have been through Pill as members, and every one of them has been able to launch an independent career outside of record company shenanigans. So I think that's a good thing. There's been internal arguments inside Public Image, and quite right and all, because you can't expect human beings to all get on with each other all of the time. I've managed to write the songs I really, truly, totally believe in. I'm able to do the work I most want to do. Yes, it's a complete success.
So the first Pill album, the reviews in England were almost uniformly negative.
Fantastic.
Thinking about it, yeah, how did you feel about that? You look kind of gleeful about it now.
I don't make records for record reviewers. I make records for, firstly, myself, to satisfy my own curiosity as to what it is I like about music, and then the public, the people that come to the gigs, the people that want to hear what it is I do. Record reviewers, well, they're basically nasty-minded fuckers who are supported by the record labels. Because without the record labels, these pop magazines wouldn't have existed. They needed the advertising money. If your record label isn't fully backing what you're doing, you'll get negative reviews. And that's exactly how it operated. Guaranteed negative reviews. The labels weren't really thrilled with the originality that was coming out of the records. They wanted, at this point, the Sex Pistols Part 2. But when they had the Sex Pistols, they didn't quite want the Sex Pistols, so there it goes. as the story of my life musically has been, I'm several steps ahead of the game.
Yeah.
Second, third Pill album. Well, it's still not backing me fully. Misunderstandings and or whatever. And I've got to be honest, I didn't make it easy being the kind of person I am. But then they would be signing up bands that would be starting to be influenced by public image. And there's quite a bunch of them out there. And then they would support them fully and financially and back that. And that's a very annoying situation, that you see your ideas stolen by your own labels, you know.
Yeah.
And given to what I termed at the time lesser mortals.
I'm totally stealing that phrase. So Flowers of Romance, right? The third Pill record.
Yep.
Totally different than what you were doing before. Very percussion heavy, you know, lots of drum loops, stuff that was in a lot of ways ahead of its time. You were facing half a year in jail when you were making that record. How did that affect
before,
what came out?
Just before. I went to visit my brother's band in Ireland and got involved by attacking two policemen's fists with my face and looked at 6 months in jail for that. Very lucky to get out of that. But when I did, I rushed straight back to London and straight into a studio. Now, the tragedy of that was that the Pill members around at the time weren't very particularly interested, so I more or less did the whole thing on my own. I had to do drum loops because Martin Atkins, the drummer, he'd booked another tour with another band of his, and so he could just lay down some basic beats and had to leave after a couple of days. So I had to improvise, and I did real well. That's... I picked up saxophones, violins, anything I could bash a rhythm out on. My favourite sound on it, of course, was ashtrays on the piano strings. That metallic tangle. That's basically my first attempt, I suppose, at a solo album. But John being John, I still gave credit to the members that remained.
Yeah, Keith played a little bit of guitar on that.
Very little. The rest of it was me with a bow.
So on this show, we'll often have a lot of hip-hop related guests, so I wanted to ask about your song with Bambaataa, the Time Zone song.
The world destruction, your life ain't nothing. The human race is becoming a disgrace. The rich get richer, the poorer getting poorer. Fascist chauvinistic government.
How familiar were you with rap music before
doing
that?
There was no rap music.
Oh, Malcolm had already, at that point, was pretty heavily involved. I think he'd done Buffalo Gals 2 years before.
No. I think you're getting things mixed up here. Mm-hmm. There was no rap music. There was no title rap. There was all hip-hop or anything at all like that. There was a lot of things floating around. Bambaataa was particularly good at combining... we'll call it Euro trance, like craft work, mm-hmm. with Funkadelic and that wonderful mixture of records. And that's how we approached it. What there was Toasting, of course, which is Jamaican.
Right.
And then all these titles came after. Hip hop, all of this followed.
Lydon and Bambaataa's song World Destruction was released in 1984. In 1982, former Sex Pistols manager Malcolm McLaren released the hip-hop song Buffalo Gals with a world-famous Supreme team. Younger listeners might know it as the song Eminem parodies in the beginning of Without Me. McLaren got the idea for the song after meeting Afrika Bambaataa at a Bronx Park jam sometime earlier. The two were introduced by episode 45 guest Michael Holman. In fact, Holman was the first to use the term hip-hop in an article in the East Village Eye in January of 1981. The article, appropriately enough, was titled An Interview with DJ Afrika Bambaataa. And of course, despite what Lydon says, the term rap music was in wide circulation by 1984, when Lydon made the song. It was receiving national television coverage as early as 1981, with the 2020 story Rappin' to the Beat airing that spring.
What do you remember about making that record?
It was great the first fun. Time. I really like Mr. Bambaataa a lot and always will. Mm.
That was the first time you worked with Bill Laswell, right? That song?
Yeah. Yeah. And quite a few other people that led to the Golden Palominos. We put out a lot of like records that had different names. And in fact, I did that for quite a lot in the 20-year period that followed. I've put out many, many records under different names and had to because, you know, I could be sued by the label. I had to be a very careful bunny.
Yeah. You met Bernard Feller on that session, right?
Bernard, fantastic chappy.
What did you learn about singing from him?
How to hold a tone without suffocating it. And in a very subtle way, I really liked the sound of his voice. So then we just got things really well together and used that on Rise, actually.
Could be wrong. I could be right. Could be wrong.
Bernard Fowler is an American musician, songwriter, producer, and actor. He's provided backing vocals with the Rolling Stones for over 25 years and has been a regular featured singer on other musicians' recordings and tours. He has appeared on over 30 albums.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually wanted to talk about album, which is the record you did with Laswell after that.
It's when you work with people like that in very small little ways, you find that you have more range than you ever imagined. But it's always, always, always work in as many different areas as you can musically. Try everything. You'll find out some fantastic things about yourself. The trouble with most people, though, is our insecurities. And so that stops us learning.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about album is the personnel on that was nuts, right? That was, you know, you had fired your band and Bill got session players. He got Steve Vai.
We got whoever was available instantly. And what a pile up that was.
Yeah. What was working with Vi like? I mean, he was
It got more terrifying by the second as the names got, you know, more glittery, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. I mean, you know, that might overwhelm some people, but me, it's like, oh, my God, this is going to be really, really difficult. Fantastic. Because I wrote the songs beforehand. I knew what I wanted. But as always, when you work with different people than you had the idea originally with, it will shape-shift it somewhat. And so no two people ever play the same way.
Yeah. What was it like having a band of that caliber at your disposal? It was like Ginger Baker and Vi and...
For me, the biggest thing about it was that these people respected me. And I did. Up to that point, I've got to tell you, in music, I wasn't aware that I was respected at all. And I was quite shocked and surprised by that these very, very big names and motivational musicians, we'll call them, had a lot of good things to tell me about myself. I've not considered it.
So jumping ahead a little bit, the album Nine, there's a lot of military imagery on that record. What influenced that? Why
really?
Did that,
that was my attempt at pop music. And I jest you not. I suppose it's the way I was structuring. I was using the concept of cliches too. Hmm. And so that they come in very rigid poetic beats. So maybe that's why it occurs this way to you. But I do like a marchability in a song. I like the way football hooligans chant.
Which makes sense. You were no small amount of football hooliganism as a youth.
I'd read books about it.
And another odd bit of imagery.
Cheer up. It gets worse. Cheer up.
Another odd bit of imagery that comes through on your solo record on Psycho's Path, there's a lot of nature that comes through there. Air, sea, sun, that kind of stuff recurs, and not always positive.
Send me the sun, let nature take me. Looking for some, but nature hates me. You sink a ship, we all go down. Rattle swim, men will drown.
Well, everything has a yin and a yang to it. It's a bizarre album because of the subject matter. I jumped from extremes like psychopathic behavior, which the song Psychopath is. It's a study of a serial killer. And I had to jump into that frame of mind. It was deeply unpleasant to do that, but fantastic to deliver it vocally. There's other songs like Grave Ride, which is like facing the situation that you might see your loved one murdered by a political calamity. Leaping from one thing to the other. And I always use nature elements anyway. They're always there. There'll always be boats and sea and oceans and lawns and things flirting around because I love the visual tapestry of life. I'm jumping from one thing to the other. I can't help it now. I'm on a roll. So, you know.
Yeah.
Fuck you. I'm happy talking with myself. I posed to myself the question once, would I be happier losing my eyesight or my ears or my voice? I can't give up my eyesight. Everything else can go, but I never, ever want to lose my eyesight. And yet my eyes are seriously injured from meningitis when I was young. I'll always be able to paint, see? And for me, my songs, they're landscapes, they're paintings. I see them visually in my head, in colours.
And that came to fruition on This Is Pill, where you painted the cover.
I've always done the artwork. Did you not know this?
Let that slip. But on the This Is Pill album, you have the song The Room I Am In, right?
Mm-hmm.
It says, wherever you are, you're in heaven.
Nowhere what you are in, it is always in itself, always also in heaven.
And I saw an interview that you did around that time where you talked about even during literally the most difficult situation of your life, watching your mother pass away, that in some sense, it was a reminder that this is heaven. What did you mean by that?
Life. life. Even if you're locked up in prison, whatever, you're still alive, and in here you're free, and this is your heaven existence. I'm convinced, I've been locked up, I know, you cannot take that inner freedom away from me. Don't care about the physical torture aspect or the confinement. I'm alive in here until the day I die. No one's going to steal that from me. That was taken away when I was 7, and I got it back, and it's mine forever.
Reggie's song on that record uses a lot of Garden of Eden imagery.
We're seeing no reason for leaving the garden. We shine like a beacon in the Garden of Eden. There are no bad seasons, no reasons for leaving.
Mm-hmm. Which for someone so, you know, notoriously against organized religion might strike people as a little odd.
Well, the concept of Eden is a good one.
How do you mean?
A place where we don't lie to each other. And the snakes appear to be very comfortable there. The Garden of Eden is a state of mind where you're at one and level with every other human being around you. And Reginald is a very, very close friend of in particular, Mr. Rambo's and mine. And he's quite insane in his way, but there's something really wonderful about his company and his exuberance and love of life. And bingo, he deserves a song, and he got one.
I wanted to talk about punk rock for a second, since you're so closely associated with it. He's making a funny face.
No, I'm sweating. It's hot in here.
Oh, okay.
It's really hard to think under this heat.
Can you talk a bit about the role of women in the early days of punk? You've often said your favorite era of punk was the very beginning, when women had equal footing as band members in groups like the X-Ray Specs and the Adverts, and the Slits, of course.
And the Raincoats.
In a way that would disappear pretty quickly. How did that start, and why do you think it changed?
In came the punk cliches of bands in studded leather jackets. I've got to say, Sid fits unfortunately into that mob too. And that then began to dominate. The media would focus completely on that aspect, and a lot of those crap male bands, they loved it because they didn't have the intelligence to write decent songs. They couldn't put two sentences together. They used violence as a cover-up for talent. And that completely obliterated what it was supposed to be originally, which was an act of individuality, where each and every person was a single concept of beauty up unto themselves. Blew it all out the window. Thank you, record companies, of course, who needed this because they were going for sales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said that something happened once the mass media kind of got a hold of this subculture.
Yeah. They started to box punk into a category and thereby limited it. Absolutely limited it. And this is unfortunately what happens. We see this with rap. Rap turned very quickly into a Taco Bell advertising.
And in fact, that brings us something else I wanted to talk about. So you wrote this essay about Alice Cooper, right, for his box set. And in it, you talked about how society is always needed in order for individualists to make sense. They basically need something to rebel against. They need what you called 4 very strict brick walls for it to make sense. As society's changed, as you've changed...
This came from an old joke that I made up years ago, but what's my name? Rick O'Shea. Because I bounce inside 4 enclosed walls.
Nice. Have you found, as you've changed, as society's changed, have you noticed ways in which the walls, like society, its mores have adjusted? Has it gotten harder to rebel, to be an individualist?
The walls are kind of, in a weird way, necessary. It does. It gives you something to focus your mind on. But the walls should not be permanent and should be adaptable. Unfortunately, a lot of people think like sheep, and I'm not one to bleat amongst the flock. And as soon as I get myself found trapped in a category, I'm very quick to leap to the next thing. I already have the next thing planned. Audiences can be a bit slow with that, if you're moving from one conceptual ideology to another. But the consistency in me is the sense of values. What I'm doing in life musically is I'm exploring emotions. I'm trying to find an answer to what emotions actually really are. You cannot do that limiting yourself. Cannot.
And, you know, you're often, you know, your music, especially early stuff, is slotted into punk rock, which sort of in the popular mind, people think of it as sort of antithetical to disco. But I know you were and are
disco.
A huge disco fan.
Yeah, I've made this very clear.
Yeah.
So I'm horrified by alleged punks hating disco. They are instantly my enemies for that.
I saw you
and
get
I'm
a
king of the punks, and they're telling me what's what. Fucking audacity.
I saw you get. I saw you actually get tearful talking about Donna Summer's passing.
Donna Summer's died today. That breaks me heart. What a wonderful person that was. Oh my God, the music that woman made. She broke down so many barriers, so many. And records were wonderful. For my mind, that was the openings. That was the audacious beginning of rave culture. Gays loved her. Straights loved her. Hooligans loved her. Everybody loved her. She crossed all barriers, and she didn't ask for no credit for it either. The voice of ultimate honesty. Ah, you will be missed, Donna. You will. I take death so bad. Can you just give me a moment? I get like this. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. Mean it. These are very relevant things to me, and I cannot understand the idea of narrowing your outlook. To want to isolate yourself and not allow yourself to be entertained by fabulously entertaining things, people sharing their feelings with you. And you want to sneer at that? Well, then you are my enemy.
And what about the
relationship? As far as I can see, I'm probably the only person who completely really understood what punk is. And I never liked the title punk anyway.
What about the relationship between glam rock and punk rock? You know, you say in the book that it was pretty complicated. It wasn't just like antagonistic. You weren't just coming up against the glam rockers.
Not at all. This is very much a serious part of my musical inheritance. Things like T-Rex, I love and adore. That's the most sensational sound. That Tony Visconti production thing was just heaven on earth to me. Gary Glitter, child molester though he became, still bloody great, them records. So many good things came from glam rock, and a lot of the fellas in it, right, covered in mascara. But it was done with a sense of humour. It was very, very aimed at girl audiences, which is not a bad thing at all. What glam rock turned into, though, was goth rock. The makeup was still there, but it went very Dracula. And that was a tragedy. And I don't think really seriously any of the early punks had any problems at all with anything glam rock. Not at all. It's the lot that came after that did the sneering, that did the damage.
And in fact, that humor was one of the things you loved about Alice Cooper so much.
Absolutely.
I love the dead before they rise. No farewells, no goodbyes. I never even knew your now rotting face. While friends and lovers mourn your silly grave, I have other uses for you, darling.
Absolutely. He told me a fabulous story once, how he was you know, the hanging scene.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the piano wire snapped and he literally was hanging. This is Alice and Mine's way of having humor. A near-death experience.
And one more music, music-related thing. So you've been basically consistently bad-mouthing The Clash almost since they were formed.
I don't think that's bad-mouthing at all. I'm consistently asked to talk about something I find excruciatingly dull. I like the fellas in there. Mick Jones and Paul, the bass player, are really good friends of mine. Right? No, never had a problem with them. But every time I try to do anything, I'm always asked about these other things. And look, if I was a plumber and they were plumbers, do I have to love them because their U-bends are different? No, stop it. You know, leave me alone and don't ask me about other bands and then you won't get negative on me.
Hmm.
I have to tell you the truth when you ask me a question. That's it. It's not negative.
Yeah.
That's my opinion. That's not negative. I love them as people. Don't love the work. Why should I?
Now, one or two more final things. You said in an interview a long time ago that your exact words were people who believe what they read are fools. Does that apply to people who buy your book?
That was a reference to the Bible. And taken out of context, that can seem pretty snarky of you to use it that way.
Okay, that's fair.
Yes, it is.
All right.
But that question wasn't. You should know that.
While Lydon is correct that the quote hadn't been given any context here, he wasn't originally talking about the Bible. The quote comes from an interview he did with Melody Maker in October 1978. He was talking about the critics who had misinterpreted Public Image Limited's first single, Public Image. He said, "People who believe what they read are fools. I think the record far surpasses everything else around, a gem in a pile of shit. I quite frankly think Public Image is brilliant. I think it's superb, and I think I've got a wonderful voice."
Mm-hmm. And one of the odd things you've done in your career recently was arranging to play King Herod in a production of Jesus Christ Superstar. I was interested in this because you said that you finally were part of a team and didn't have the responsibility of a leader, and you really enjoyed that.
Well, no, it's I had to accept that there was a director who was telling me what to do. I've never been in that position ever musically, and the entire different way of singing and projecting and doing tap dancing and stuff. This is bizarrely challenging, seriously risky for me. Loved it. And I'll tell you why, because theatre people, I realised, are really, really generous to each other. And I've not quite ever seen that outside of Public Image, really, in any other band. It's always been animosity and contempt and spite. Theatre people aren't like that. They back each other. What a pity they pulled the plug on that. That would have been a sensational tour. I learned so much from those people. Fantastic. You see, you take these different directions, as I did, diving into doing a musical. Oh, how appalling. What a sellout. Bollocks. As long as I live on this earth, I'm going to do things that I'm not expected to do, because I know there's an answer in there. There's something that can further me as a human being.
And one
it's
final...
It's back to the four enclosed walls, isn't it?
And one final thing, because I know you have other places to be. So one of your best-known songs, Rise, right? The one where you get the title of the book from.
No. The Anger Is an Energy comes from when I was 7 years old.
Mm-hmm. But that's the song that uses that line.
I didn't take the title from the song. I already had that in my mind when I was young. Read the book. You will learn this.
So that song, you know, mentioned is about, in part, torture in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, during the sort of the height of the Sun City boycott, I was curious, would you have performed there?
I've never been asked, so it's a pointless question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's proposition came to us a couple of years back as Public Image, would we play in Israel? We jumped at it. And so demonstrators turned up outside gigs in Britain saying, don't support the fascist regime of Israel.
Johnny. Yeah, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to ask.
Now, hello.
Yeah.
A Jew could be called a fascist? Really? You forgot World War II so quickly?
Mm-hmm.
I don't play to governments, by the way. I play to human beings. I support no government, no politician, never have and never will. So I wanted to go to Israel. It was a fascinating place, and the crowd was amazing. Here we are in Tel Aviv. There's Arabs and Jews in that crowd together singing pill songs. Unity. That's how the world's got to be.
Okay. I mean,
no student demonstration talking shit.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time.
May the road rise and the enemy always be behind you. May they scatter, flatter, batter, and shatter. We're back at the four enclosed walls. This is a pill song. The refrain in it is Allah. Allah. I can get Jews in Tel Aviv to sing Allah. I've achieved something really wonderful about us as human beings, and I. Thank you. I did.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Can I go home now?
Yes, I think you can go.
I'm taking you home now.
No, but I get an hour's sleep, which I desperately need because I'm tired because this goes on. And I've got to deal with Fox.
When listening back to this interview, one phrase really stuck out at me, and I'm paraphrasing here, so I may get the exact wording wrong, but it was Lydon saying that his whole artistic career was spent exploring human emotions, honestly. And the reason that stuck with me is I feel like that is key to both the positive and the contentious aspects of his personality, all of which were on display in this conversation. As you can hear, Lydon was opinionated and very passionate. But it's that same emotional honesty that has made his music so vital for the past 40 years. In order to operate in that kind of territory, you have to be really honest about what you experience, what you think, what you feel, in order to be able to write about it. And that comes out to a fault during this conversation. There definitely are some contentious moments, like our little back and forth about exactly when the term rap came into common usage, or when I present him with an out-of-context quote that I thought was playful and he thought was sandbagging. But I think ultimately, there's stuff in here about his life and his songwriting that you just won't find anywhere else. And believe me, I've looked basically everywhere. I know that a punk and post-punk singer isn't the usual kind of guest we have on The Cypher, but Lydon's influence on music, the music industry, and culture is pervasive and runs through all genres. Meeting Lydon, you definitely see he's still the exact same person who managed to polarize a whole country 40 years ago. Join us next week when our guest will be my longtime favorite and a true living legend, Murs. We talk about his whole career, from his early days selling homemade tapes to passersby on the street, all the way to his new album, Have a Nice Life. Make sure to join us then. You can find The Cypher on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, future guests you'd like to see, anything you'd want to talk about. You can find a list of the songs played on this show and more information at our website, thecyphershow.com. While you're there, you can check out our entire archive for free. And don't forget to donate at patreon.com/thecyphershow and to rate, review, and subscribe to The Cypher on iTunes. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sitaro.
Fuck you, I'm happy talking with myself.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Don't love the work. Why should I?
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
What a bunch of assholes they are. They are instantly my enemies.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Will you two stop fiddling about? You know, how am I supposed to do this if you keep that up? I don't work in a bus station. Sorry, it really gets to me. I'm trying to focus.